From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. This piece has become familiar by now, almost too familiar for some. It's the prelude to Suite No. 1 of Bach's Cello Suites. You hear it at memorials and funerals. It's ubiquitous, this piece, but you can't call it ordinary. In Eric Sibelin's book, he describes the notes as unfolding with the storytelling power of a master improviser. A journey, he says, has begun. So if the suites themselves are a story, so are the details that brought it to the public's attention. Today in the program, Eric Sibelin is joining us to tell us the story of Bach's Cello Suites. We invite you to join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist and music critic Eric Sibelin spent years weaving together the story of the Bach Cello Suites. It's hard to find any hard evidence about this music, but it could be said these six suites represent part of the story of Johann Sebastian Bach's life. There are elements of joy in here, as well as resounding grief. And the story of how they came to the world's attention, well, that's a story that's almost hard to believe. It's about how Pablo Casals, the renowned cellist, discovered the unknown then, suites. We're talking about one of the great pieces of music of all time, and Casals stumbles upon it in a secondhand store in Barcelona when he's 13 years old. Eric Sibelin is joining us today to take us through the story, which is full of passion and intrigue and politics, and of course the music itself. His book is called The Cello Suites, J.S. Bach, Pablo Casals, and the Search for a Baroque Masterpiece. Eric Sibelin is a journalist, a documentary filmmaker as well. He was a reporter and a pop music critic for the Montreal Gazette. He's written for a number of magazines. His documentary film, Word Slingers, about competitive Scrabble tournaments, aired in the United States and in Canada. The Cello Suites is his first book. It came out this year in paperback, and he's joining us today from a studio in Montreal. And Eric Sibelin, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
So I wanted to begin. Let's talk about when you first heard the suites. Very first heard them. And it wasn't really that long ago. It was 2000, as you say in the book. It was this concert at Toronto's Royal Conservatory of Music. And it seems like in some ways you kind of just happened upon the concert. I mean, you were visiting the city and you saw a newspaper listing, I guess.
Yes, that's exactly how it happened. It was very much an eeny, meeny, miny, moe type exercise where I was looking for something to do that evening. And I took a chance on music I knew nothing about, performed by a cellist I'd never heard of, Lawrence Lesser, who's from the Boston area. And I was really quite struck by lightning during that recital. The scene itself is very dramatic. You've got a solitary cellist on stage in this neo-Victorian concert hall. He's dressed in dark formal attire, a shock of white hair, bent over this majestic instrument that had been built back in the 1600s. Mm-hmm. So just the sheer surroundings and the ambience of the venue and the performer was striking and poetic.
Well, the first thing you heard was that was the prelude from Suite Number 3, and I want to play an excerpt of it right now. We can talk about it in more detail and play more of it as we go along, but I wanted to play a bit of it because I wanted you to explain that lightning strike, I suppose, and what it is you heard. Let me play a little bit of this. Let's hear a little bit of this, and then let's talk about that moment. Thank you. So Eric Sibelin, what is it you're hearing? You describe in the book that Lesser's there playing alone, like you said a moment ago. So he seemed to be defying the musical odds, is how you put it. So what was it there that you were listening to? You were hearing the, kind of something spare and austere and almost unlikely, I guess.
Yes, I mean, I think of it as defying the laws of musical gravity in that a cello is a relatively simple instrument by design. You've got four strings and one bow, that's it. And yet the music that he was conjuring up was so lush and full-sounding and multi-layered and oceanic, really, that it struck me as incredible. To hear the music also is sublime, of course, but I think, as with the case of almost any music, to see it being performed up close is all the more compelling. And that's certainly the case with the cello suites, because you see, and I was able to see, the fingers of the cello sort of mapping out these perilous sort of shapes and forms and pretzels on the fingerboard. And so you get a much more visceral sense, I think, of what's behind the performance of the music. And it's doubly sort of hypnotizing as a result. And I was hypnotized.
You say in the book that that evening you might have been searching for something without knowing it. What did you mean?
Well, I had actually quit my job as pop music critic at the Montreal Gazette, the daily newspaper here. And, you know, after being inundated with pop music, everything from Celine to Slayer, I really wondered what would come next for me in my listening life. And I was dabbling with a few different types of music and I think without consciously trying to latch on to a new music, it was in the back of my head. And I think that had a lot to do with the fact that I took a chance on this music I knew nothing about, Bach's solo cello music. And in some respects, I was really ripe for conversion, as it were. And it happened that night when I listened to the cello suites for the first time performed.
So what did you know, Eric Sibelin, about the suites when you sat down that night? I mean, it's a remarkable story that we're going to work through, but did you know anything about that context when you sat down?
No, I knew zero about the cello suites. I had a vague notion of Bach, I think owing to Glenn Gould's Goldberg Variations, which every good Canadian is somewhat aware of, Gould having been Canadian.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I really knew nothing about Bach and certainly nothing about this particular piece of music. By the time I left the concert hall that night, I should say I knew a little bit more on account of program notes that were quite expertly written by the cellist, Lawrence Lesser. Mm-hmm. And he sketched out sort of an introduction to the music, mentioning all sorts of intriguing things to my mind, such as the fact that Bach's original manuscript, thought to have been written sometime around 1720, went missing. And so there's no definitive biblical source, as it were, for the music, and that means that every cellist puts his or her own stamp on the music. It becomes a sort of Rorschach test for the music, a sort of inkblot test. And I found that fascinating. And there was also mention of the great Pablo Casals, who essentially rescued this music from oblivion when he was when he stumbled upon this music as a boy, as your show mentioned a bit earlier, in Barcelona in 1890. He then went about figuring out how to play this music and championing it, and he really brought it to the concert hall for the first time. So that struck me as pretty dramatic as well. And then there were a number of mysteries contained in the music itself that Lawrence Lesser alluded to. So all of that, struck me as really, really intriguing. And by the time I left the concert hall that night, I had this feeling, this desire to write a book about the music.
It's interesting. I mean, so many questions packed in just the initial idea, you know, are we sure it was even written by Bach? Why was, as you say in the book, why was such a monumental piece written for the lowly cello? It was thought of as a lowly kind of instrument in Bach's time. Are we sure it was even written for the cello? I guess all of these questions got you going and intrigued.
Oh, yeah, very much so. You're right. We don't know. We can't be sure what instrument the music was written for. In the case of the fifth cello suite, we have actually a manuscript in Bach's hand for the lute, not the cello. And it works magnificently well, I think, on lute, and you'd be hard-pressed to figure out that whether that piece of music was written for the lute or for the cello. Suite number 6 was written for a mysterious 5-stringed instrument, maybe not even a cello at all. So all sorts of intriguing question marks sort of surround this music. The more I delve, the more these questions came to the surface, and the more I was able to connect the dots and come up with some theories as to why Bach did what he did with the music. And so it was a great, great sort of treasure hunt in some colossal library / concert hall that I embarked upon.
But I guess it's important to say that it's more than just a detective story. I mean, it's about the music itself. You break down – I mean, just the way you structure the book is less about the intriguing sort of story as much as the way that suites themselves are structured and built.
Yes, you're right. The music is the point of departure, and the music kept me going, and the music gave me a sort of scaffolding upon which I was able to build the story of the cello suites. Rather than, for example, structure the book chapters 1 to 36, what I decided to do is to reflect the structure of the music in the book itself, so that you've got 6 main sections that correspond with the 6 main suites, and each of them are broken down into 6 chapters. So you've got 36 different pieces that fit into this puzzle, just the way the music does for Bach. It starts off with suite number 1, prelude, followed by the Allemande, the Courant, the Sarabande, and so on, just the way the music does. And that appealed to me right off the bat, I think, because it was a way of embodying the music in the text, which I really wanted to do. And on a more superficial note, I love the names of these titles, Sarabande, Bourret, Gig, and so on. So yes, you're right. The music was always very, very much at my fingertips when it came to writing this book.
I wanted to ask you how the suites are used today, played today, in what settings. I mean, often found at memorial services, for example. And I wanted to refer to the prelude from number 1, suite number 1, which it's easy to dismiss that prelude because it's the most familiar. It's played over and over again. And you yourself have said you've kind of grown a bit bored by it. So it is ubiquitous. But put that aside for a moment and say something about maybe its quality, because it sort of has taken on this iconic status for some reason. What do you make of that that ubiquitous piece first?
Well, I suppose it's the first piece of 36 movements, and that has something to do with the fact that it's gotten as much circulation as it has. I'm not sure that it's any better than any of the preludes to follow. But it is a splendid piece of music. And you're right, I'm a bit bored by it. And that's sort of that's the case, I think, with any piece of music that we hear countless times. It's sort of the unfortunate price of success. Take any number of favorite pop songs, and at a certain point in time, you max out on them. You overdose. You've just heard it too well. And after all, the first prelude only lasts about 2.5 minutes or so. So it's I'm not saying one gets sick of it, but you get to know it pretty quickly if that's the only piece that you're listening to. That said, I think it's still a spellbinding piece of music, particularly when you hear it performed by a cellist you haven't heard it played for previously. When you actually see it live performed, it's hard to your mind never shuts off, because I think it really has a sort of narrative flow. There's a beginning, there's a middle, and an end. It doesn't just it doesn't just achieve some sort of groove and stay there for 2.5 minutes. It really goes somewhere. It's a real musical adventure, I think, and I believe that helped set me on my way to feeling that there was a storyline contained in the music itself. And that may sound a bit airy-fairy, but in fact, time and again, when I was wondering where to take the story, I would listen to the music, and it would point me in a direction more often than not.
Well, we're going to play some of these movements from the suites, not in the sense of trying to spoil the mystery or the fun, but we should say, as you do in the book, the ideal experience for most listeners maybe as you first heard it, that is, without these preconceptions.
No, that's right. I think that's sort of a privileged position to be in, to encounter any great piece of art for the first time and not have too many preconceptions.
Eric Sibelin is with us. His book is called The Cello Suites, J.S. Bach, Pablo Casals, and The Search for a Baroque Masterpiece. We'll tell more about the story, of course, and play more music when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the journalist and music critic, Eric Sibelin. We're talking about his book. It's called The Cello Suites, J.S. Bach, Pablo Casals, and the Search for a Baroque Masterpiece. Well, to piece together this story, you say in the book you've got to really know Bach himself. So first explain how you did that. It seems like you really immersed yourself almost completely in Bach's life and work.
Well, I think Bach is one of those intriguing figures in history about whom we know both a great deal and nothing. He's a bit like Shakespeare in the sense that we're very, very familiar with his art. And yet the man behind the art slips through our fingers. And the record of primary evidence is quite limited in the case of Bach. So I think it makes it a bit of a research challenge and a mystery to try to come to terms with Bach. Also, this is a man who was born back in 1685. So there's a great amount of mystery that surrounds Bach, and I did my best to get a sense of who he was, and that meant reading the standard biographies, which tend to repeat themselves in terms of the main milestones in his life that are well known and documented in some way, shape, or form. There are very few letters, for example, of a personal nature that have survived in Bach's hand, and so the very few that have are very often quoted and at length. Beyond that, I think I tried to become acquainted with the Bach-loving community, and that meant joining the American Bach Society and going to one of their conferences. And I think all that combined to give me a sense of Bach. Certainly reading about the history of his time and place helped as well, because he wasn't godlike, though he may appear. He wasn't living in a vacuum. He spent the last 27 years of his life in the town of Leipzig in Germany before Germany was unified as Germany. And so at the end of the day, you do get a sense of Bach, I think. And he clearly was an individual who lived for his art. I think that comes through.
Mm. It's interesting you talk about these portraits, authentic portraits that had been painted of Bach, both by the same painter and practically identical. But you say the images in the book sort of helped cultivate this image of Bach as, you know, severe and stodgy, kind of stuffy. But you say that's not really what he was like. I mean, especially when he was young, he seemed really impulsive and as you said, living for his art, really passionate.
Yes, I think you're right. And I don't think his life was as deadly dull as that portrait suggests. You know, he's got a dour expression, clutching this sort of arcane piece of sheet music, a bit overweight and, as you say, stodgy and looking. To give you an example of that, the other side of Bach, which is known to have existed. He got into a sword fight with a bassoonist whose playing he disapproved of as a young man. He, on another occasion, he was insisting a little too forcefully on a job change, and his employer, the Duke of Weimar at the time, threw him into prison, actually. So he did time in the clink. Bach's first wife died tragically young, and he then... sometime later fell in love, deeply in love by all accounts, with his second wife, Anna Magdalena Bach, who plays an interesting role in the survival of the cello suites and the story of the cello suites. She was a young singer. Bach met the greatest politician of his day, Frederick the Great, towards the very end of his life, and played for Frederick, who was a music lover as well as a great sort of military man. So Bach's life wasn't devoid of drama. I think he was also very much a man of flesh and blood. He liked his drink, brandy, wine, beer in particular, his pipe tobacco. He had 20 children all told. Count them, 20. 10 survived to adulthood, but that was standard fare in the early 18th century. So Bach was clearly, I think, a man of flesh and blood. He was, he was of the world as well as being in the world.
I want to go back to one of those moments you referred to, because I want to play parts of the prelude anyway from suite number 2. But you write about how Bach, he's 35 years old. He returns home from this trip with a patron of his, Prince Leopold, and he learns that his wife, as you say, has died. I mean, we're talking about a woman that he's been with for many years at that point. They'd had a number of children together, of course, and you say that his sense of anguish over the death of his wife, you think that that can be found in the prelude to suite number 2?
Yes, I think so. First off, it's very, very hard to listen to the prelude of suite number 2, even the first note. You can listen to one single note bowed on the cello, and it's hard to escape the sense of tragedy. I think it's clearly a melancholic movement. The entire suite number 2 is quite melancholic, and so that in and of itself planted the idea in my head that perhaps Suite 2 had something to do with this tragic premature death of his first wife. And then sometime quite a lot later in the course of my research, I was very interested to stumble upon musicological research that in fact pointed to just that and suggests that at least two or three movements, including this first prelude and the later Sarabande, and the minuet were in all likelihood written as a sort of epitaph, a tombeau, as they called it in those days, using the French word, for the death of Maria Barbara, Bach's first wife. And of course, it's not smoking gun evidence, but it is sort of a tantalizing musicological proof that that there may be a connection. There may have been a connection. And yeah, that's one of the many, I think, examples of where the music dovetails with the storyline and with Bach's own life.
Well, let's play a part of this prelude, because you say that the listener, you say, is forced to imagine what's going on. You say there are gaps here and fragmented lines here. Let's play that and talk a bit about it. Sibling, you say that harmony was Bach's specialty, but the question is, how do you get harmony with just one instrument? You call it implied harmony, that he sort of leaves notes out. What, he's stripping it down? Is that the idea?
Yes. You were alluding earlier to the gaps and the fact that we're forced to use our imagination. And I think that's true with the life of Bach. And it's also true with the music in musicological terms. Now, I'm not a musicologist, and I really tried to treat this this book as sort of a very general exercise and in music appreciation. So I stay away from a lot of the jargon, mostly because I don't understand it. But as I understand, what Bach was accomplishing here was very much something called implied harmony. Namely, the cello is a melody instrument. It can't achieve harmony in the conventional sense of the word, which is bowing two or three notes simultaneously, producing chords and harmony. Instead, you've got the sort of successive notes strung out on a vertical line, on a horizontal line, as it were. Now, how does Bach achieve harmony with a melody instrument? Well, he sneaks different lines in at different times. He'll give you a fragment of a phrase and then move to another fragment, essentially forcing the listener to use his or her imagination, in many cases in an unconscious way, and fill in those musical gaps and have a sense of harmony and even of polyphony, which is the braiding of two or more musical lines, which in fact was Bach's specialty, when you hear several things going on at the same time. Now, it's much more of a challenge to do that on an instrument like the cello, say, unlike the piano. And Bach does that. He also does it with arpeggios, for example. You're playing the notes that comprise a chord. The very beginning of that piece of music we just heard was I believe, the arpeggio for a D minor chord. Those first three notes that are so tragic and establish this kind of gut-wrenching sorrow of the piece are, in fact, three notes sounded one after the other to form a minor key chord. And those are the sort of tricks and tools of the trade that Bach uses, in fact, to accomplish harmony with what's a melody instrument. It's really quite remarkable.
You talk about how the cello suites for a cellist. This is it's a rite of passage for a cellist, I suppose.
It is. I think in part because not a lot of music was written for solo cello. I mean, it was incredible for me to learn that not only had this not been done before Bach. In fact, there's one case of an Italian who wrote music for solo cello late in the 17th century that Bach may or may not have been aware of. But it's nothing like the scale and the ambitiousness of the cello suites. But beyond the fact that this was quite novel in Bach's time, say 1720, more or less, when he was writing this music, it boggles the mind that another two centuries went by before a major composer decided to tackle solo cello music again. And that was Reger, I believe, in 1914. So the cello repertoire was limited in terms of the greats who had composed for solo cello, and that's part of the explanation. The other more, I think, obvious explanation is this music does represent a kind of Mount Everest of the repertoire in terms of its technical rigor and emotional depths. And so you're right, it very much became a rite of passage for many cellists. And interestingly, today the music is played on a variety of other instruments, so that not only cellists cut their teeth on this music, but so do guitarists and lute players and a shocking number of other instruments.
Well, it's interesting, too, how difficult it is to play this piece as a cellist. I mean, you write about how it's kind of an arduous effort, sawing and hammering and pulling and pressing. You interviewed a cellist in Europe when you were there who said that the suites was the most difficult program he'd ever played or ever would play.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's true. And I took some cello lessons, although I'm not a cellist, in order to experience this difficulty, which I can certify. It is a very physical instrument, and the bowing in particular is very arduous if you've never done it before, which I hadn't. And it's there's no question these pieces, particularly as you move on among the suites and you get to suites 4 and 5 and 6, they're extremely difficult. And it's very common to meet top cellists who say, "Well, yes, I play most of them, but I haven't had the courage to deal with suite number 6 or suite number 5 yet." One hears that a lot. They're difficult, and then the fact that you're alone on stage, quite naked, performing this music with nothing to hide behind and no other instruments to blend in with, I think makes it all the more daunting.
Mm. Well, as we head into a break here, I wanted to play some from the Gigue, the final movement of suite number 3. And this is intriguing. You've said that you hear some rock and roll in this movement.
Yeah.
Yes, I do. And you reminded me that Cello Suite Number 3, where this comes from, was the first suite that I heard live. And I wonder if the fact that I did hear some rock and roll in there at a time in my life when I was very much steeped in rock and roll, I can't help but wonder whether that made the whole thing more accessible to me in a way that perhaps a full-fledged Baroque orchestra with lyrics in 18th century German might not have worked its magic on me. Yes, there's a spot in the Gigue of Suite Number 3. I think it starts about a minute into the piece, and then it comes back 3 or 4 times. That really sounds for all the world to me like an electric guitar riff, and I always think of somebody like Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin cranking out this sort of anthemic rock hook that lasts for several seconds. And it's incredible to me that Bach, after all, composed this music 200 years before the electric guitar was even invented. So more proof that he was ahead of his time.
Eric Sibelin is with us. He's the author of the book The Cello Suites, J.S. Bach, Pablo Casals, and the Search for a Baroque Masterpiece. We should say that the book came out this year in paperback. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment, you're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Eric Sibelin, journalist, filmmaker, rock music critic. He is the author of the book The Cello Suites, and we're talking about his book today. It just came out in paperback this year. Well, I guess we should say that we have a sense then of who Bach was. But the story is not complete, of course, without Pablo Casals. He did, after all, discover this music, or rediscover it anyway. So how did you set out to find Casals as well and learn what you could about him?
Well, that was infinitely easier. I mean, Casals was one of the very great musicians of the 20th century, the greatest cellist of the 20th century, and a superstar musician for a good chunk of that century. He lived a long time. Although he was born back in 1876, he made it until his mid-90s and only passed away in 1973. So as a result, his career was quite well documented. And it's infinitely easier to go through the primary record of whether it's newspapers or biographies or works of music history and get a sense of Casals and as well as archives and letters and all sorts of material that, in fact, helps one flesh out the life and career of Pablo Casals. In that sense, he was a very useful counterpoint to the life of Bach, which is so shrouded in mystery. But again, as you point out, Casals really resurrected this music. He championed it. He made it, I think, the famous, iconic music that it is today. So you can't very well write any account of the cello suites without dealing with this larger-than-life figure that is Pablo Casals.
Well, take us through the day when Casals, and keep in mind he's 13 years old on this day. It's afternoon, you say, sometime in 1890. And his father, now he's gone to Barcelona, as you tell it, to study music. He's starting to play there, sort of professionally anyways, but he's playing more and more. He's becoming an up-and-comer at the cello, of course. He's captivated by it, almost obsessed with the cello. And his father comes to visit him, and you say we have a picture of Pablo and his father sort of walking along an avenue in Barcelona. And this day he actually buys his first adult-sized cello, and I guess what they're just looking for sheet music, basically.
No, that's right. Although Casals is the tender age of 13, he is a very accomplished cellist by this point, despite the fact that he came from a village by the name of El Vendrell and is now just starting to make his mark in the big city of Barcelona, where he left his family behind initially, and his father remained in the village. His mother eventually moved with him to Barcelona, but he was playing in a cafe trio most nights of the week, and was developing a name for himself, playing light music of the kind that people could sip hot chocolate beverages and smoke and play various games to. On this particular weekend that you mentioned, young Pablo was out with his father looking for sheet music that he could use for his burgeoning career. And sure enough, they walk into one particular shop of secondhand sheet music, and he sees some Beethoven cello sonatas and then spots this copy of the cello suites by Bach, and he can't believe his eyes because he's never heard of this music. Of course, he's heard of the immortal Bach, but he had no idea that Bach wrote music, in fact, for solo cello, for his instrument, for cello alone. He quickly exchanged pesetas for this music, and one imagines that sight reader and musician with perfect pitch as he was, he could start to hear this music just by reading it from the get-go. He went home and immediately started to figure this music out. And it was as if he was figuring it out for the first time. He personally was. But unlike cellists today who, are confronted with this difficult music, a young Pablo couldn't go into a music shop and much less the internet and choose between dozens and dozens of versions. He couldn't consult state-of-the-art early music performance manuals. He didn't even have a teacher who he could ask, how is this stuff played? So he was decoding it, and he spent a dozen years figuring it out, mastering it, imbibing this spirit of the music before he mustered the courage to start playing an entire cello suite in public, which was really a radical thing to do in 1901, which was around the time that he first started to play entire cello suites in public.
We should say another element of this story is music and passion, but politics as well. Pablo Casals gets caught up in the civil war in Spain, the rebellion against the monarchy and the rebellion against the fascists. And in many ways, it seems that now the suites take on another personal cast. They have the sense, we have the personal story of Bach, but when Casals is playing them in the context of this upheaval, they take on yet another element of texture. They become even more personal, it seems.
Yes, you're right. And I was surprised to learn how often politics bumps up against music. I mean, this was a purely aesthetic subject matter so far as I could see when I set out to write about it. And yet politics would appear repeatedly, even back in the time of Bach. But with Casals, as you mentioned, it's most conspicuous. I don't think he began life as a political animal, but I think the circumstances of being a Spaniard, in particular, someone from Catalonia, the sort of ruggedly individualistic province of Spain, especially in the 1930s when all of Europe was becoming politicized one way or another, Casals found himself very much on one side of this very turbulent political debate. He identified with the people, as he would have described it, a democracy as opposed to the fascists who were led by General Franco and his forces in Spain. And in fact, the music that we've been listening to today was recorded in the 1930s, beginning in 1936, just after the Spanish Civil War had broken out, and ending in mid-1939, just after the Spanish Civil War had ended, forcing Pablo Casals to go into exile in France, just over the border. He would have been in grave trouble had he stayed behind in Spain once Franco and his troops took over in January of 1939. So the recording itself of this iconic piece of music, which was the very first complete recording of the music, and it's incredible to me, by the way, to remember that this took place about a half century after that initial encounter in 1890. The music wasn't released until the early 40s. But Pablo Casals, I think, had very much the Spanish Civil War on his mind when he recorded this music in three separate installments. And although you've got 1930s production values, a certain amount of snap, crackle, hiss, and pop in this recording, beautiful as it is, and it is beautiful, it's like an Old Testament version of the music, really. It's somehow all the more convincing, the fact that it was recorded in the 1930s. But there's a level, I think, of urgency and hopefulness and sorrow that contained in this music that I think might not otherwise have been there had Casals not recorded this music during those harrowing political years of the mid to late 1930s.
I want to play. Let me just play another bit, just because I think it's important to listen to it in the context that you just mentioned it. He records the second and the third suites first in 1936.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We should keep in mind that the violence, the bombings in particular back in Spain, had to have been on his mind. I mean, they're in the news. He's worried about his home country, of course. I mean, it's kind of a wonder, Eric Sibelin, that he could concentrate enough to perform. But he absolutely does seem captivated by it, does he not? I mean, it just seems interesting to think about him performing in the context of all that turmoil.
Yes. I mean, he was first and foremost a cellist, and I suppose for him performing was tantamount to breathing. But it took a great deal out of him energy-wise to record these suites, and perhaps it's an example of how humanity can sort of transmute some of their most difficult, sometimes positive, sometimes negative, but most heartfelt passions into music in a sort of cathartic way.
Let's play from a suite number 4, the prelude there, because there's another element here as we're thinking about the Casals version of this that I wanted you to say something about, because you detect an Eastern element in this piece, maybe something Turkish or Arabic, even Hebraic, you say, which is interesting. Maybe say something about that.
Sure. For me, the beginning of suite number 4, particularly in the hands of Casals, sounds very much like a difficult work. I hear somebody shoveling and digging, and it has almost a mechanical sense of heavy clockwork. And there's something laborious about it, a sense of struggle. And I think that's what was going on for Pablo Casals at that point in time, given how how searing the political struggle and how laborious it was in Spain at the time, and how tragic it was. You're right. The business about something near Eastern happens a couple of times. I think it first pops up about the middle of the piece, and to me, it really raised my eyebrows, and I wondered, what is this? Could this have been something Bach had envisioned and heard, or was this a sort of embellishment that Casals grafted onto the music? Because it does sound very much as if it could be near Eastern, Turkish music maybe, Jewish music quite possibly. It's got a real sort of lament quality that would be more at home in a house of worship, I think, than the, you know, the performance hall of, say, 1720.
Let me ask you, Eric Sibelin, what became of the manuscript in Bach's hand? We it's just gone. We don't know. But you say in the book that various manuscripts have been discovered over time. You hope it turns up, but you don't think it will really change much at this point.
No, I think that's one of the ironies, is that I found myself spending a fair bit of time wondering and where the manuscript might have ended up and what might happen were it to surface. But I think by the time I got to the end of the book, I realized that this music has been interpreted in so many different ways that even were Bach's original manuscript to materialize with more specific instructions as to how the music should be played, I think that everything's – or a great deal has been imagined at this point in time. Moreover, Bach's manuscripts didn't tend to have a lot of super precise what's called indications in musical language. He wasn't like Beethoven, who really specified with great detail how every sound was to be uttered. This wasn't Bach, and this wasn't the Baroque practice, the time that he lived in, and the musical style that he embodied. So I'm not sure it would be very exciting, but I'm not sure it would change the way the music is played all that much. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about this music. Earlier today, I actually listened to a version I hadn't heard before by a great Italian cellist by the name of Mario Brunello, and he did something in the same suite, the Sarabande of Suite Number 4. He began it and he ended it plucking the strings as opposed to bowing them, using the technique known as pizzicato. And it was glorious, and it excited me a great deal to hear something that I hadn't heard before. And I think that goes a long way towards explaining the charm of the cello suites. Is they do sound very different in the hands of different cellists, and I think that's the way it should be, and I hope it's the way it continues to be.
Mm. Well, we're going to ask you, Eric Sibelin, since we're out of time about here. We have a question from Greg in Provo, and I'll put it to you, and then we'll maybe get your response and put it on our website. What are your favorite, the best recordings of the cello suites? Because I want to move finally then to the prelude from Suite Number 6. Because you say this final prelude here, you describe it, talk about a bolt of lightning, you describe it as a bolt of lightning, and you sound like, you said this sounds like an orchestra. You hear trumpets here and strings and drums. Say something about this prelude finally.
Yes, I think that as the suites progress, they become ever more intricate and complex and demanding and ambitious. And you feel that by the time you get to the suite of Suite Number 6, the final suite. Now, in part, this is a result of the fact that it was composed for 5 strings, not 4 strings, perhaps not a cello. And so there are more resources at the disposal of the cellist. Not every cellist plays a 5-stringed instrument. Some will use a conventional 4-stringed instrument, as Casals does. But still, there's a sense that it's pushing the envelope here, and it's going beyond everything that's come before, and there's a real sense of transcendence. You feel that in the music, and I think it's unquestionable for me. And it's a brilliant ending.
Eric Sibelin, he's a journalist and a filmmaker based in Montreal. His book is called The Cello Suites, J.S. Bach, Pablo Casals, and the Search for a Baroque Masterpiece. It came out this year in paperback. Eric Sibelin, thank you very much for the time.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Cynthia Martinez. We had technical direction today from Michael Havey. The program is produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.